Hello, people. This is the Extra Spicy Podcast. I'm Justin Phillips. On this episode, Soleil and I speak with Linda Hsu, an internal medicine doctor, cooking teacher, and author of her first cookbook, Spice Box Kitchen.
I didn't have to go to medical school to tell people how to cook greens. And yet, this is actually the most powerful innovation that I've made as a doctor.
All right. So there's a lot packed into this episode. We talk about the ancient practice of food as medicine. We talk about that really interesting journey she took from being a doctor to, you know, being a chef and a cookbook author. And we also talk about the power of her prescription pad, which she uses to motivate patients towards better eating habits. So we're excited for everyone to hear this interview. We hope you take something away from it. And here you go.
So one anecdote in Spice Box Kitchen that I love is your story of prescribing kale chips, like a recipe to a patient. And I feel like that's such a great encapsulation of what you do. So would you mind telling us that story?
So I was looking for literally another tool in my toolkit, another tool in my, you know, my figurative doctor's bag. Nobody really has one these days, but I literally had all these prescription pads. And I thought, all I ever do is write for more prescriptions, for more blood pressure meds, for cholesterol medicine, diabetes meds. And of course, you know, we have to. I'm not saying that we cannot, we have to take medications away from people at all. But I thought, what else can I use this for so that it's official, right? So there is a distinct power in a doctor's signature on a prescription pad and what it says on it. It becomes not mandate, but this is a very strong and very official recommendation. And I think it symbolizes my knowledge and as a medical doctor and all of my training. So it's more than just writing a grocery list. And so this was kind of an experiment. I thought, okay, I'll try this with a patient that I know well and who I know has a sense of humor and might not feel really weirded out by this. And I remember that patient was a guy who, he didn't actually work in food professionally, but he loved food. And he was a volunteer at the local farmer's market. And he had a lot of struggles with all the stuff that we all have, all the chronic illnesses related to food, again, blood pressure, cholesterol, and I think he was pre-diabetic. And so in most of the visits I'd had with him over years, it was kind of like, okay, blood pressure is okay, continue this. Cholesterol is still a little bit high. What are you eating? Continue this prescription, blah, blah, blah. You know, you got to lose some weight or else you're going to have diabetes one day soon. So then I thought, well, I'm more interested in hearing actually about the specifics of what was he eating? What did he like about the farmer's market? And so he told me, you know, the weekend before that there were all these great mushrooms. And he told me, you know, at great length of how he enjoyed cooking them and a lot of butter, all this stuff. And he was very excited. And when you're trying to connect with somebody about anything, either change your mind or just connect, it's that moment of excitement is your opening, right? So he was excited in talking about his kind of recipe, his way of enjoying produce, which is great. Mushrooms are great. And so I said, that sounds really good. You know, what other vegetables do you like? And he's like, oh, you know, I know that you're going to tell me to eat more green vegetables. I don't really like them. I was like, well, what do you like to eat? Are you a salty snacker or a sweet snacker? Right. There's often a divide. And he's like, oh yeah, chips. I just eat chips all night long when I'm watching TV. And I was like, well, I have an idea for you. So this is how the kale chips came about. I was like, if you like chips, I know this is different, but if you'll just try this, it'll take 10 minutes of your time. The next time you're getting ready to watch TV, why don't you try this recipe for kale chips? They will have that same salty satisfaction that you like from potato chips. They won't be as crunchy, but they'll be crisp and they're much better for you. And I think it might be a way that you can start to enjoy some greens. And he was like, huh, you know, his eyes kind of were like, wow, maybe you're a little crazy here. but he wasn't offended and he was intrigued because it was kind of like, I was sort of speaking his language with this. And it wasn't just, again, like kind of a lecture of, you got to stop doing that. No more potato chips for you ever. But like, if you like this, you'll like this better, right? And I will be happier because I know it's going to help your health. And so that emboldened me. And so then I also came up, my second recipe that went on a prescription pad was for the sweet snacker, the person with a sweet tooth. And often that person with a sweet tooth who is eating something mindlessly while they're watching TV at night eats ice cream. And so that became a recipe for, you know, banana nice cream, where you just basically freeze overripe bananas that otherwise would go into these days pandemic banana bread. And then whiz them up in a food processor, and you can add anything, nuts, chocolate, berries, spices. And so that was my second recipe. And I have to say, I still use both of these, and I've converted both of those into electronic prescriptions now so that they're ready to go. And so that's another thing, you know, not just reaching people when they're kind of feeling excited or emotional, but doing something that's a little bit off gets people's attention.
Oh, wow. It feels very avant-garde, right? Like that's how the avant-garde reaches people too, just by like freaking them out.
Yeah. Exactly. But you know, this is like responsible freaking out. That's kind of how I am as a person. Like I like the idea of doing crazy things, but I'm still kind of afraid to do that with my professional reputation. But I still believe in that power of just, yeah, exactly as you said, in the avant-garde, freaking them out so they pay attention. Their eyes are open.
That's very San Francisco.
I remember around 2017, 2018, there were a bunch of stories that I used to see that were like this emerging field of culinary medicine and people writing about it and talking about what it, you know, what it consisted of. I'd be curious from you to talk about what is culinary medicine and how has it changed over the years?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, if you think about it, culinary medicine is a new name, but it's for a very old concept, right? That we are what we eat and food really is medicine. It was our first medicine. So if you want to think about the beginning, it really goes back to like Hippocrates, right? Father of modern medicine, ancient right. Greeks. And also in other traditions, traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurveda. All of these are really the original culinary medicine. Well, I don't think ancient Greek medicine with, you know, leeches and balancing the humors is still practiced these days. But Ayurveda and traditional Chinese medicine, both still, if they're being practiced in the way that they were meant to be, haven't changed all that much from mm-hmm. thousands of years ago. And those two systems, which I only have, you know, a very superficial understanding of, but would love to know more, really use two things. They balance people's constitutions, and that's measured by things like, you know, their pulse, various other physical traits. They balance that against the types of foods and the properties that they believe those foods should have. And so these ideas have been around for millennia. And it's just that people, I think, as we modernize and kind of aim for technology as what we consider advances, have often forgotten about this. So culinary medicine as a, you know, field, I think it sounds very official, right? It sounds a little bit strange also and avant-garde, but it also sounds like a specialty, right? So if we can categorize it in a way in the Western medical lexicon, it sounds like another specialty. And there are probably some people who would like to see it become something that you can become board certified in. But truly what it is in its modern definition, which I think was coined by one of my mentors and inspirations, John LaPuma. He defines it, and I think it's the best and most succinct definition, as combining the art of food and cooking with the science of medicine and nutrition. And so that's really what it is. But it really is just food is medicine, right? So that we should not actually forget that if we fail to address food and what we put into our mouths as being at the root of our health and wellness and having the power to affect all disease processes, we're never going to really make the impact that we can for ourselves or, you know, as a medical provider for our patients in their health. We can't. No matter what we do with all the medications in the world, you're not going to feel good and we're not going to do our best to optimize your health. You need both. That's really the key. When I first wrote that kale chip prescription, that was in 2012. So many years went by in that time and I had time to learn about lots of stuff. And yet at that time, it was a radical idea. I really felt like I better not let too many people at work know that I'm doing this because maybe I'll get in trouble. Maybe this is malpractice to be using my prescription pad for this. And then I really think that people thought it was a little bit crazy. I can't say that I had many colleagues who were on board. It took some years. And things have improved over time as more and more people have gotten interested in this concept. concept. So Justin, that's my very long answer to what is culinary medicine and how has that changed over time? Basically, it's been around forever, but there has been increasing interest. And I would say over the last 3 to 5 years, more and more.
So how do you explain the disconnect between, you know, like the absence of nutritional information in like medical schools, you know, previously and still largely, and also just the, you know, the relative rarity? You know, you spoke to how it changed, like, and how there are more people interested in culinary medicine, but like still there seems to be a big gap between like the historical sort of ancient practices of like Ayurveda and like now. So how do you explain that gap?
Yeah, I would say that the overall answer, two-word answer to that is Western medicine. And Western medicine, as it's practiced in the Western world, relies upon licensure. And licensure is based upon things that are considered scientific, for which we have evidence and that can be tested, right? So we take a lot of tests as medical trainees. And I think because of that, things which are explained by other thought systems, which include Ayurveda and traditional Chinese medicine, they're thought not to be science. I think it's as simple as that. So if they're not thought to be science, then we're not going to teach it. That's one thing. Now, nutrition is a science. I think that is a slightly different reason why it's not integrated into medical school. Now, to be fair, there is so much that we have to learn as doctors, and there's only a limited amount of time, which is still a long, long amount of time. And essentially everyone's young adulthood who becomes a doctor, speaking from personal experience. And so there's not time for everything. And so I think when decisions are made in what goes into the curriculum, that is one of the considerations. Like, although I would say maybe we don't need to really know organic chemistry. I don't know. But at any rate, it's thought to be, you know, maybe more than we need to know because there are people who do this, registered dietitians, as their job. And they are frankly better, right? I'm not a registered dietitian. I don't have that exact training that they do in terms of all the things that they do. That's not a reason not to educate us to the extent that we should know so that we can most effectively partner with dietitian. I think that's the goal. And, you know, we will use our skills of, you know, learning how to help people with behavior change. We will use our access to people as someone who has some influence as the doctor to a patient, but we still need to have someone else's expertise. Unfortunately, at least in this country, and I'm assuming in other sort of, in other parts of the Western world, if not elsewhere, it's just a very kind of formal conservative institution. And so that's why slightly avant-garde ideas don't fit in as well.
You're listening to the Extra Spicy Podcast. We'll be right back after the break. You can support this podcast and the newsroom that creates it by subscribing to the San Francisco Chronicle at sfchronicle.com/pod.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I'm Justin Phillips, and we're back with Linda Hsu, an internal medicine doctor, cooking teacher, and author of her first cookbook, Spice Box Kitchen.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like what you're practicing is, for instance, you go to the doctor and they give you like the handout that says like eat more leafy greens, and that's sort of it. What you're doing is telling people how to eat the greens, essentially. Does that make sense? Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. I tend not to be very succinct, but you honed in on it. That's basically it. It was my, you know, I'm someone who used to do bench research. You know, I was a scientist first, and also thought, I think, along these lines that innovation meant science and technology and all this stuff. And not against that at all. But truly, that's not where my passion is now at all. And so I like to say this is not rocket science. This is not brain surgery. In fact, I didn't have to go to medical school to tell people how to cook greens, right? I didn't need to do that at all. And yet I actually thought, this is actually the most powerful innovation that I've made as a doctor. There are lots of doctors out there who could have done this, but most doctors don't do this. And I thought, just like with anything else, we are all like subject to information overload. We're all given too many handouts. There are too many emails. How much of that do you actually read and retain? And even if you want to, let's say you are the patient who is told to eat more leafy greens. You look at the list, you're like, okay, yeah, I guess I'll pick some of the stuff up when I go to the grocery store the next time. You bring it home and you're kind of like, oh, I don't usually eat this. What do I do with this? And then it would take many more steps to go from being that sort of non-home cook who doesn't, or the person who doesn't cook vegetables, to, I guess I'll look up a recipe, to, I guess I'll figure out how to cook this recipe, right? Because a recipe is still only a list of instructions and ingredients. And so I thought, why not cut out the middleman? Let me actually show you. Let me inspire you. If you eat this and you like this, you're going to do it. Once you see how easy it is, once you've done it, you know, the beauty of teaching cooking, what's so exciting for me is that we make mistakes all the time and it's not a disaster. It's not the end of the world, but there are, you know, it's all a learning opportunity. So like, okay, you didn't make sure there wasn't enough moisture when you cooked those greens. And that's why they're still kind of undercooked and yet burnt at the same time. So this is how we fix that. We can either fix this now or let's start over. And next time you'll do this. People need actual, literally, it's not to be spoon fed. It's to actually like, come with me, come cook next to me and we'll figure this out together and make sure that you like eating this.
So, okay. How is all of this different from the sort of broader trend of like wellness and, you know, hiding diet culture behind wellness? You know, like it is very mired in like fat phobia, and there is certainly a history of fat people having really bad experiences with doctors who just tell them like, stop being fat for like everything. So can you articulate the difference?
Oh, I hope that it's thought to be completely separate from all of that, to be honest. I mean, I think that whole wellness culture is actually pretty modern. You know, I think that's about 10 years old. There's always been diet culture separate, but this whole new, like all-encompassing wellness culture, which is very monolithic and very kind of North American and wealthy and white, all of those things, and excludes a lot of people. I'm not part of that. I think the way that I get away from that is I'm really I love food. I've thought about in great detail about what does it take for most people to be healthier. So I'm talking about health as in metabolic health, health as in do you feel good? That's the wellness I'm interested in. And no matter how you eat, whether you're completely vegan or plant-based or just eating some vegetables or mostly plants, whatever it is, in general, if you're eating kind of more minimally processed food that you're cooking yourself at home, that you have control over the ingredients, that you have control over the selection of your ingredients, and that truly is mostly plants, you're going to feel better. So that is what defines wellness for me. I deliberately don't include calorie counts in my recipes. That was a kind of a big thing to convince people that this is going to be a healthy cookbook, but it's not going to have calorie counts. Because while portion control is important, I think that we can accomplish that by having mainly vegetables or mainly high fiber foods, because you're going to be full. That's the best way to accomplish portion control. It's like literally be mindful, eat what you like. If it's mainly plants, you're going to stop when you're full. And that's all you need to do for portion control. I also make it very clear that the food that I encourage my patients and my students to eat, and in my cookbook, is that it's not a diet. It's not meant to have you lose weight. You might lose weight. And that would be a great bonus if that's important for you, but that's not the plan here. Again, I'm not that smart. If I wanted to make a lot of money, I would actually invent a diet, but I'm just a very honest person. So I'm not going to pretend that there is a one size fits all diet that is going to make people lose weight. That makes sense. It's never going to happen.
As a doctor, right, who interfaces with people, patients, how do you handle the diet conversation or like the food conversation in a way that is, I guess, gentler than people generally experience?
Yeah, this is, it's a work in progress and it's very individual, right? So the best way to do it though is truly just kind of figure out where people are. on their journey. And I look at people's vital signs, right? Their weight is part of the vital sign. The BMI or body mass index is one of the vital signs. It's something that I will note and I will put on people's problem list. I'm not going to pretend it's not there, but I will then ask, do you want to talk about your weight? And if the answer is no, then I'm like, okay. Now, if the answer is yes, I chose you because I know that you're a nutritionist. And I'm like, no, I'm not a nutritionist. I have gotten some additional training in nutrition. I'm very interested, but mainly I'm a cook and I love food and I am really happy to work with you however you want that to be with this. And so I think what kind of differentiates like the tools that I keep in my toolkit is I have like a gazillion, at my fingertips lists of, yes, you look like you could benefit from more magnesium. Here's what you should eat. You look like you need more iron. Here's what you should eat. Oh, you want to cut back on carbs? Yeah, that's reasonable. Another one of my recipes that I have at hand is for cauliflower rice for people who like rice, but feel like they shouldn't eat as much rice. And also kind of an introduction to whole grains, those sorts of things. And so I really make it more about like, I will talk to you about these foods and the ways of preparing them and these incremental changes that you can make that will kind of gently nudge you in the right direction. But if you really want to plan, let's work with a dietitian. That is completely necessary. I can't do it all myself in 20 minutes.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm just thinking about like the past and also friends who are fat who have talked about this, right? Like their doctor will just say like, you should lose weight. And then just like, it just sends them down the spiral of like, okay, but I have a headache, right? It's so weird.
You mean like, like they're missing the whole reason why the person
right,
is there
yeah.
by only seeing their weight.
Yeah,
is that what you mean? The thing is though, I mean, it's not like there are not fat doctors either, right? It's not like there are not doctors with very poor lifestyle habits. There are many, many doctors out there.
Yes.
I've seen TV. Yeah, I know.
So I don't think that we have any monopoly over, we shouldn't feel superior, I should say, about who we are or where we come from. We're just people. We just happen to have a certain set of professional skills. And so it is wrong to come talk to someone from the stance of, I know that it's bad to be fat, so you better not be fat anymore. But why are you here? That doesn't help. Like in general, and I think I'm still a work in progress as a doctor too. Like these are, it's not always obvious how we should approach our patients. The modern medical training does emphasize communication a lot more than it used to. And I think I was at the very beginning of that when we actually got courses in communication. And those courses, can be summed up in as be open-ended and ask why the patient is there and listen to them and then go with that. And so I am hopeful that again, this next generation will be better and those sorts of experiences will be fewer and far between, but they'll still be there.
Mm-hmm. I love the idea of, you talking about having to think about the approach to different patients, because I'm sure you deal with people from, various socioeconomic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to, and this goes back to talking about like the personal element of talking about food and prescribing food to people. Mm-hmm. When it comes to, let's say, the economic angle of it, mm-hmm. because I know some people might think healthy eating could be expensive for them if they've never done it before. Or you might have some patients who have limited incomes and, think like, man, I don't know if I can actually go out and get the things that I need to follow this. How do you have those conversations with patients? Do you have to factor in, these various elements, like, someone that might be suffering from food insecurity, mm-hmm. or someone who, admits that they have limited income, like, I'm sure that's complicated, but how do you walk that line? How do you do that?
Yeah, it is complicated. And so I think the first step actually is is asking about it in a very gentle way and a, you know, mm-hmm. very non-judgmental way of, and actually the pandemic has made it a little bit easier to ask that. It's normalized mm. now. Like yeah. the pandemic has made it really hard for some people to get the kind of food that they know is best for them to eat. Has that been an issue for you? Because, you know, I have resources, right? So the first thing is just asking that question. And then I think the other part is to address the, I think, misconception that eating healthy has to be more expensive. And mm-hmm. I think that is the kind of healthy eating that that whole Western wellness complex, that industrialized wellness complex that I'm not part of, makes it seem, right? That mm-hmm. you need to buy superfoods. Mm-hmm. So superfoods, especially superfoods that get packaged, drive me crazy, because these truly could be superfoods, right? They're very, that what a superfood truly is something that has like high nutrient density, whether it's vitamins, minerals, fiber, whatever. And these are typically things that people who come from other cultures have been eating forever. They might be weeds, like, you know, mm-hmm. moringa, for example, right? Grows like a weed. And now it's being packaged, and I think it's expensive. And also it's not food anymore, the way that people process things. All that is to say is that I think people have a concept of health food being a certain kind of food because of the way it's being portrayed in the media. So, you know, there's mm-hmm. the whole kale and quinoa crowd. Mm-hmm. I love kale and quinoa, and I'm not going to say that these are not good things. And they are actually can be relatively inexpensive, maybe not quinoa so much, but kale is. And so, but I do have to acknowledge that it is one of the hardest things to compete with is like the McDonald's dollar menu. Yeah. I can't say that I can beat that. I actually cannot say that, but in one meal. But I propose that if people eat more plants, mostly plants, right? So not meat, not processed foods, not eating out, and kind of rethink how they think about their food budget in terms of, I'm going to buy in bulk. Maybe I split it with my neighbors or my extended family. I buy my stuff from the farmer's market. It'll be, you know, the highest in nutrient density because it's the freshest. It'll be the least expensive because it's in season, mm-hmm. you know, all those good things. And then I buy my grains and my beans in bulk, right? Get all the stuff in bulk. That's not expensive if you kind of average it over time. Mm-hmm. I also like to talk a lot about the value of frozen fruits and vegetables. So while I'm always like, don't eat processed foods, I don't mean that kind of processed foods. I always have some frozen vegetables and some frozen fruit in my freezer. And they actually can be higher in amount of vitamins than something that has been sitting on the shelf at Whole Foods for a couple of weeks, honestly, right? So the closer you are to picking something, the more nutrition it has. And most frozen fruits and vegetables are flash frozen, close to the time of picking. And that's really inexpensive. I think a lot of us realized that when everyone was pillaging the freezer aisles in the beginning of the pandemic, because we were afraid we're going to starve to death. And you're like, oh, this is great. This is great. You know, this is really inexpensive. And you know, it's convenient, right? So that's the other part of it. That's the other thing. What, I guess this is my treatise on what does the McDonald's dollar value have on me? And so it's the fact that it's a dollar. It's the fact that it's fast. So frozen stuff is also fast and it's also cheap. And then the final kind of restructuring of how one should think about what is the cost of this to me is, what is the cost of your life? What is the cost of your health? And this is not a philosophical thing of you're worth it. This is actually, if you're sick because you're eating the McDonald's dollar menu every single day, you're going to be in the hospital. You're going to miss work. You may not be able to work because you're sick. And maybe these are all things that we can prevent if we get you eating just a little bit better. And so that's the other thing I always like to emphasize. A lot of people think it's all or none. So for that person who relies for economic reasons on the value menu, the dollar menu at McDonald's, maybe, you know, maybe that's their lunch because they don't have a lunch break and that's what they can do for lunch. But maybe at dinner, then they start by adding in a salad, whatever it is, you know, add something good. Don't always make it about saying you can't have this, say, you know, you can have this. And then eventually people are like, you know, I actually feel better and this wasn't that expensive and it wasn't that hard.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense to me. So I think it would be great for us to just maybe end on, where can listeners, if they're interested in your stuff, find your work?
these days I'm all over the place, but I'm about to launch my first cookbook, Spicebox Kitchen. So this is a cookbook that really kind of encapsulates everything I've been talking about eating mostly plants, about diversifying what we consider to be healthy food, about using kind of the traditional cuisines around the world that have always been largely plant-based, and figuring out more interesting ways from those cultures on how to flavor our food, because it is all about flavor. So in this case, I focus a lot on spices. And then you can find me on social media at Spicebox Travels on Twitter and Instagram, and at The Doctor's Spicebox on Facebook, and finally at my blog, spiceboxtravels.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Linda.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Linda.
Yeah, have a great day, guys.
Thanks again to Linda Hsu for being in conversation with us, and to Erica Carlos for producing this episode. If you're enjoying Extra Spicy, please share it with a friend and give it a rating on Apple Podcasts. And remember to send us any questions or voice memos you may have about food, life, or anything else for our Dear Spicy advice segment at extraspicy@sfchronicle.com. Thanks for listening.